The First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution begins, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Historically, the first clause there, the Establishment Clause, was understood to mean, here in America, we will have no national church, like the Church of England, from which many fled. But in the mid-20th century, a Supreme Court decision changed the understanding to mean there should be a wall of separation between church and state. The effect of that Everson versus the Board of Education case, 1947, at least on the parts of some government officials, is to essentially try and chase God out of the public square. Dr. Greg Seltz is the Speaker Emeritus of the Lutheran Hour. He serves as the Executive Director of the Lutheran Center for Religious Liberty in Washington, D.C. And he joins us now to discuss church-state relations, past and present. I'm Dr. Jerry Newcomb. This is Focal Point. Greg, it is always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us again.
It's my pleasure to be here, Jerry. Thanks.
Okay, what are your understandings as far as the First Amendment, especially historically and then more recently?
Well, you know, it's so funny because, yes, in one sense, if you have a small, almost limited federal government and you say, well, should that federal government be Christian or should it be secular or whatever? Well, like I always said, if all the government's job is to do is to fix a pothole, just fix the pothole. But when you have an expansive government that's in every aspect of our lives, our founding fathers would have said that is exactly the opposite of what we had intended for the federal government to be, and we sure don't want it to be secular because they set the individual citizen motivated by his faith to be self-governing and in control of their own lives, and the government was supposed to get out of their way. So the founders were worried about a government corrupting the expression of faithfulness and orthodoxy and church, you know, and things that were the realm of the faith. They actually wanted the citizen to be able to do those things because that's how they thought God wanted government to be set up and in service to the people. So, yeah, it depends on your view of government right off the bat. If you have an expansive view of government, you have the wrong view, or at least the anti-founders view of government.
It's interesting, too, how today you see a lot of secularists like groups like Freedom From Religion Foundation, right, or the ACLU or that kind of group. They'll sue even an administration. Oh, you've got, you're violating the separation of church and state. For example, I remember even when Obama was sworn in, didn't he have a prayer from Rick Warren at his inauguration? Oh, and then some,
yeah,
you know,
those were the days, right?
Yeah, some atheist for the day, you know, sued because, oh, you can't, you know, you're violating separation of church and state.
Yeah. And again, establishment of a religion is that, you know, it would be a state, federal state church for the whole country. And the founders said, no, that's what we're against, but we're magnifying the expression of faith in the public square. We're not reducing that. And so these folks actually want an expansive state and a secular state, and they want to drive religion out of the public square. Now, here's the point. If you do that, and there are people who think, well, that might be a good thing. If you do that, you're going to lose all your liberties because the Christian biblical worldview is the foundation of the kind of liberties we have. The secular Marxist worldview will destroy those liberties. So will the Islamo-fascist worldview, which merges church and state. The other one drives the church out of the public square. But your freedoms will go right along with it. Because James Madison said, if you have a duly elected and a duly constituted state and a duly constituted church that have authority in our culture, then you, the citizen, will be free.
Hmm. Well, you know, you look at some of the popular socialist candidates lately, right, that have been, sure, winning different elections, they're coming from a Marxist base. Marxism, of course, is atheistic at its core. How does that jive, you know, with America's historical understanding of, you know, this is one nation under God?
Well, the funny thing about it is it's the great heresy of our modern times. The modern Marxists have learned the concept of benevolence is a great PR piece to cover what they really are seeking, which is power. And the most affected by that notion of benevolent government are Christians who don't seem to understand that when you merge benevolence with the coercive power of state, you're gutting the church. You're demoting the church. They just think sounds nicer. If we have a nice church and we have a nice state, we're going to have even more freedom. And the Democrat socialists have learned to say that. But what they're really saying is the government benevolencing you by stealing from one group and giving to another will take the place of the church. Show me in history where they've taken the place of church. The French Revolution, they took the place of the church. Communists all over the world have taken the place of the church, gutted the church. What ensued? And that's what will happen here as well. But we've fallen for that because we have so much freedom that we even think, well, let's make the government a little bit nicer too. The government's job is to be coercive to bad actors, and we limit that coercive power because it can become corrupt. And that's what the founders understood. And a republic then sets the citizen free to live their freest life, faithful to God and to neighbor. And that's, they said, that experiment will give more liberty to more people than ever in history. And that's exactly what's happened.
You know, it's so interesting, too. I remember when I was first working on a book, I know you're familiar with this book. I wrote it with Dr. D. James Kennedy called What If Jesus Had Never Been Born?
My favorite book.
Oh, well, I hope the Bible is your favorite book.
One of my favorite books.
Okay, second favorite book. You gotta, come on, you got to have the Bible in there first.
Well, the Bible is always number one.
Of course, absolutely. Okay, so there was this book that I found in our research as I was co-writing the book about the 1960s, and it was a book by an evangelical, and he was commenting on Johnson's big society. You know, we're going to have the great society. We're going to eliminate poverty. We're going to declare war on poverty, and we're going to win. And this book was saying, who can oppose this? And then, you know, in other words, how as a Christian could anybody say, oh, that's wrong? But they miss some points here, because what ended up happening, the Great Society, not only did it ultimately bankrupt society, and it actually, in many ways, it exacerbated poverty because it broke the back of the family. It basically said, Dad, if you stay in the house, Mom's going to get less money. It incentivized Mom to have more babies, even if they were with other fathers. And so, you know, next thing you know, you end up subsidizing illegitimacy. And those family households just went down and down and down as far as, you know, upward mobility. It was tragic.
And what I say is the Christians absolutely can oppose this. And here's why. And this is, you know, I talk about this all the time, Jerry. Our tradition is what we call two kingdoms. God engages the world two different ways, radically different. Law, gospel, church, state. Those are two different words. They're both God's word, but they function differently. And when it comes down to things like give to Caesar what is Caesar's, God is at work through Caesar, but to preserve the world, not to save it. So Caesar's limited. He has law and order things to do. His job is to curb outward bad behavior, especially like murder and stealing and dishonoring family, you know, the Ten Commandments type stuff. But from a state point of view, we just judge actions, not intentions. That's all the state can do. And when you have a good state doing that, it curbs those evil intentions. Well, when you have a state actor who says, my job is not to curb, my job is to benevolence, and he flips it on its head, it actually becomes a terrible thing, because now the coercive power of the state is taking the place of what can only be a changed heart with God. And that's where Jesus says very clearly, he tells Pilate, you only have the authority that God gives you. And when it comes to Peter saying, I want to use the state to protect you, Jesus, he goes, put your sword away. So we've got to get back to the understanding that when the state creeps into the realm of the church, that can only be bad for everybody. And we as Christians are allowing that to happen today when we fall for this, what I call heresy, the heresy of the benevolent state.
So that's a really very, very important point. I mean, in our very lifetime, Greg, you look south of the border and you think of Hugo Chavez. Venezuela was the most, if it was not the first wealthiest country in all of Latin America, it was the second out of all those different countries. And then it became a basket case because of Hugo Chavez, in the name of supposedly helping the poor. they ended up, you know, essentially imposing communism, and everything was bad thereafter. And in fact, the most recent earthquake probably did more damage than it would have if the buildings had been built better, you know, right, without the communist influence.
Well, I look at it this way. I say it's hard to share the gospel in a failed state. So if you're thinking about evangelism, if you still have the, what we're saying is a good state, a good government's role is civility and justice, and we're going to limit it because it is run by sinful people. Caesar was a sinner, and he wasn't probably even a Christian, but Jesus said he's got a role to play. And good government cannot save us, but it can prevent bad things from happening, but bad government can destroy. You don't even have to go to Venezuela to look for examples of bad government, because every city in America, major city in America, is being run by the politics of what you talked about with Lyndon Johnson. On steroids, well, can you tell me that these blue cities are running well? No, because they've destroyed the family. They've got intrusive government. They create dependency. And there's an elite political class that runs this thing. That's not how America was designed to be. The politicians were meant to be our servants, not our masters.
Okay, we have just a couple minutes left, believe it or not, in this discussion. The two kingdoms idea sometimes gets criticized for having led to Nazi Germany, you know, and I would like your response to that.
Well, I mean, there was there's a secular movement that actually demoted the church as well. Actually, you know, Germany still had a state church, and that was a problem. And our church actually became one of the free churches that fought against Nazi Germany. So America finally got the two kingdoms, I think, more correct, where they decoupled the church and they decoupled the state. Because back in Germany, you know, pastors actually functioned to do governmental things like marriage and, you know, roles of citizenry, et cetera, et cetera. So I think the two kingdoms did not create that, but you had state churches under the auspices of the government that was problematic. Same thing happened in England. Look at how unfaithful the church is in England today. Similar thing. America finally decoupled, and James Madison probably had a better understanding of Luther's two kingdoms when he said Luther was the forerunner of the Bill of Rights. So there's a lot more I could talk about. That's a whole nother show in itself. I don't think two kingdoms created Nazi Germany. Secular government created Nazi Germany.
You know, I was just looking at a quote today from James Madison, and it was very interesting. He says, it's called, the name of this document that I was looking at was called Memorial and Remonstrance, right, Against Religious Assessments. And the gist of it is that if we're saying that, you know, citizens, ordinary citizens have to pay for religious things, even if it's against their conscience, he said that's not the right way to do things. He said that, basically, while we have been convinced by the evidence that, you know, essentially Christianity is true, I'm paraphrasing him, others have not been so convinced, and to force them to assess or to pay for the promotion of Christian doctrine, you know, basically they don't like it. And he said this is not good in terms of even the advancement of those Christian, you know, things. And I think at the end of the day, he's been proven right over time, you know, through the separation of the institution of the church from the institution of the state, then you have competition. So one church is out, you know, out competing against another, and the church is growing in both cases.
Well, and that's the whole point, though. The church was meant to be freely received. So Christianity is the only worldview that separates salvation from coercive power of government. So they properly differentiate God's preserving and saving work, and they're two different works. And so, you know, we ask the right questions. What would Jesus do is the saving stuff. What would the Father do is the preserving stuff. And once you clarify it, then you can answer those questions.
All right, Dr. Greg Seltz, again, the name of his organization is the Lutheran Center for Religious Liberty. It's based in Washington, D.C. The website is lcrlfreedom.org. Dr. Seltz, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. It's been great to be with you.
Okay, great. Thanks. Bye-bye.